Pseudopod, episode 179, January 29th, 2010. This week's story, Fading Light, by Simon Strancis. Welcome to Pseudopod, the weekly horror podcast. This week's story comes to us from Simon Strancis, whose work has appeared in the Best New Horror Series and Postscripts. His newest collection, Cult of the Touch, is available from Tartarus Press now. This story originally appeared in Bernie Herrmann's Manic Sextet from Greyfriars Press, and is also in Cult of the Touch. Your narrator this week is Nero of theawfulshow.com. So get ready to look around the other side of town, because I have a story for you, and I promise you, it's true.
Fading Light by Simon Strancis. The wind, hurrying as though late for winter, carries millions of tiny knives of ice, each one cutting into my frozen face. My hands are raw and rigid, but I find enough dexterity in them to manage a pull from my cigarette. The thick leather leash digging into my other hand is tethered to a tiny dog. The terrier sniffs everything we pass, jerking at the restraint, obsessed with following its nightly routine. It visits them in order: the tree, the hydrant, the street lamp, struggling to keep the schedule it has laid out. I've been chained to this animal for 5 years now. 5 years since she left it behind. 5 years I've had to feed and walk her memory. So long now I don't tell myself, I don't even notice anymore, but she's still crawling inside my head, distracting me. The dog senses that exact moment my hold on it is weakest, and as I absently try to juggle both the cigarette and strap, it breaks free. My burning cigarette falls as the dog's brown body, a shadow through the stinging snow, bolts down Greenwood Avenue towards its next stop. I curse and chase the length of leather that trails behind it. Bags of garbage stay the dog's escape, misshapen black plastic beneath wet snow. The pile sags waist high along the side of the street. The terrier doesn't look at me when I catch up to it, too enraptured by the tearing of plastic. I can't see what the dog has found, but whatever it is, it smells meaty and pungent. Behind the mass stands a small building so unremarkable it has not been able to pierce my thoughts. Its square shape is incongruous with the rows of bungalows surrounding it, and the brickwork looks prematurely aged beneath the amber streetlight. Strung along its exterior is a line of crooked trees whose leafless branches cling to the three flights of windows like cobwebs. All of the windows are dark but one. Curtainless, on the far corner of the middle floor, it frames a hunched silhouette. I yank the reluctant dog away, embarrassed, and continue to walk. But I am inexplicably drawn back to stare at that window the following evening. The sight is the same, the crumpled shadow watching through the trees. The falling snow has lessened and I get a better look at the figure. The man seems to look not so much down, but out across the neighborhood beneath him. The other windows remain dark and empty. He is still there, in the same position, the next night, and the next. He is there for 9 days, never moving. On the 10th, all the windows are dark, and by the entrance, a white sign sits, for rent. 2 days later, I am in a restaurant having lunch with Jackson. I have left my project at home for once attempting to be part of the rest of the world. At least I try to appear that way, unlike Jackson. His shirt isn't pressed, and I smile awkwardly when I catch the waiter's eye linger.
"I don't know what I'm going to do,"
Jackson says, head cradled in his square palms, thick fingers laid upon his eyes.
"Janet just said it was over and I'd have to leave. She already had my bags packed for me. She won't talk to me and I don't even know why."
Familiarity scrapes my brain, trying to shut it down. He is asking,
"How did you deal with..."
when I cut him off.
"Where have you been staying?"
"In a motel off King Street. But I can't afford to stay for long. I have to find a place. Christ, look at me! I've been living out of one suitcase for a week now. Everything else is in storage. Where am I going to go, Gilbert?
I know what he is suggesting, even if he doesn't. There is no room for him with me. There is no room for anyone with me. Not anymore. I have spent 5 years in the house alone, just myself, and the dog, and my project, and to share it is no longer possible. He looks at me with round eyes. 5 years is a long time. But I think of the white placard. My nails find the short hairs at the back of my neck and scratch. The tuna salad I ordered will no longer sit still in me, and I push the rest away before lighting a cigarette. It doesn't help. There's still a rotten taste in my mouth. Now that you mention it, I say, taking a breath, I might know a place. I help him move in less than a week later. Even in the raining sleet, it takes only 2 hours to retrieve his belongings from the storage lot and deliver them to the short building. There is that little. It reminds me of the place Jackson and I lived during our final year of university. The corridors are filled with a partial light of 40-watt bulbs, and the walls look soiled and gummy, the odor of cooking meat and bleach sweating from them. Only 3 straight corridors, one on top of the other, each end marked by a staircase. The building feels decidedly utilitarian. Unlike our old apartment, however, there's no telling how long Jackson will be here for.
I feel like I've been robbed by myself, he says, surveying the scattered boxes. She only took the things I cared most about. Gilbert, she even took my cat. My cat! He shakes his head. All she left me was this.
His trembling hands unwrap a framed photograph of Janet and himself in Africa on the trip they had planned over a year to take together. In it, Jackson is adjusting a safari hat too large for him, trying to keep it from falling over his eyes. Janet has her brown cheek pressed up against his, focused on something beyond the photographer. Both are smiling.
I know I should throw this away, he says, but I can't. Why can't I throw it away?
I shift boxes around, wondering how I'm suddenly supposed to know the answer. I don't get home until late in the evening, long after the winter sun has set. The dog jumps at my leg, but I push it away, unable to stand its presence. By the sunken couch lies a numbered box filled with cards and photographs, their edges worn, ink rubbed into the paper, filled with her smiling face or inscrutable scrawl. On the back of each is imprinted a number, written in black pen 5 years ago, recording the order they came to me. Some are crossed out, only to have another number take their place. Sometimes it's the same number. I'm very tired, and the words smear together in my head, but I open my notebook and start to describe the circumstances behind each one. 3 weeks later, I have a string of days where I don't work on the project at all. To celebrate, I take the dog to the park, but it is too cold to do anything but leave. On the way back, I find Jackson standing beside the gathering mound of black plastic. His collar is turned up against his neck and he rubs his hands together, occasionally cupping them to his face for warmth. There is no one left, I think, who might buy us gloves. Around us, thick flakes accumulate, muffling the sounds of the street.
Those will kill you,
he says, stooping to pet the excited dog. I smile and take a long drag off the cigarette pinched between my bare fingers.
All the better. Why are you out here anyway? Wouldn't you be warmer inside?
Actually, Jackson says, his free hand scratching at his shoulder, I was waiting for you. I saw you from the window.
The terrier sniffs at the pile of garbage as he is petted. I keep my cigarette in my mouth, hoping the taste will help mask the odor. It only makes me feel worse.
How does the place look unpacked?
He watches the dog, mumbling.
I haven't finished yet.
Is there something wrong?
Jackson brushes his hands together idly. The dog barks, tracking circles in the snow.
I don't know. It's really nothing. I'm just not sure if I like this place.
You've only been here a few weeks, Jack.
I know, I know. It's only...
Well, it's my neighbors. I haven't seen any of them yet, but I hear them all the time, moving things around. I can barely sleep because of it. Listen.
He pauses.
You can even hear them now.
I listen, but I don't hear anything. Have you tried talking to them?
I would, but I don't know who's doing it. Every time I'm close to figuring it out, the noises stop. Every door I knock on stays unanswered.
Well, it can't last forever, I say, before realizing I do hear something. It sounds like a quiet rattling, but instead of coming from the building, it's closer. I look down at the terrier looking up at me, its tiny jaw chittering. It's a little too cold for standing around. Jackson nods.
Why don't you come up for a bit? I'll brew us some coffee. I could use a little company.
I wish I could, I say, pointing at the dog. But I have to get him home before he freezes over.
No problem,
Jackson says, and kicks absently at the garbage bags. There are some things impossible to share. There are good days, and there are bad days, and sometimes the bad days line up one after another until it feels like there is no end. The snow is heavy and it clings to my window frames, cutting out as much light as it can. I put my head into my notebook on Thursday and I don't lift it again until the following Tuesday, furiously trying to piece her reasons together. I don't think of anything else. I'm on my third box before I realize how long it's been since I last saw Jackson. It takes a ringing telephone to remind me. The sound is startling, breaking the late afternoon silence, and somehow, even before I answer it, I know it's him. Uneasy, I pick up the receiver and hear static like crumbling cardboard on the other end. I call his name repeatedly, but only my tinny voice is returned to me, echoing as if over some great distance. I hang up the telephone. Through the evening, the telephone rings twice more with the same results. Irritably, I try to call Jackson back, but the line is unanswered. There have already been blackouts during the winter because of the snowfall. I wonder if his telephone line has been affected as well. It's been a long time since I've spoken to him. A long time since I've spoken to anyone. And I call the dog to me, putting the autopsy on hold. Darkness crowds the outside of the square building, bringing a biting chill. The snow has stopped for the moment, leaving the sky glittering with millions of tiny lights. There is a layer of ice smeared across everything, and those few cars that brave Greenwood do so slowly for fear of losing control at the slightest brush of the brakes. Underfoot, the dog leaps back and forth silently through the snow. The building's outline blurs with the black sky, punctured by the single light that silhouettes Jackson's form. The image itself fractured by the leafless branches between us. A half wave to him elicits no response, so I secure the dog's leash to the iron fence by the entrance and go inside. The building's corridors have not improved. If anything, more bulbs seem burned out, leaving the passage half lit. Jackson's floor is the worst. The entire length is dark except for the light through the translucent stairwell glass and a single beam from his door, an inch wide, cleaving the hallway in two. My gentle knock goes unanswered. A nudge swings the door a few more inches, exposing the apartment. It hasn't changed. It is still halfway furnished. All the larger items are uncovered, but the smaller items, the details, remain packed away in their shipping boxes. It's a painting with no small strokes. At the room's opposite end stands the bed, its length parallel to the window. Seated upon it, facing out the glass, is Jackson. His hands sit in his lap and he is shirtless, his shoulder blades cutting hazy shadows into his broad back.
Are you all right?
I ask, pushing past the door.
I wanted...
The sound of something heavy scraping across the ceiling distracts me. Jackson seems oblivious.
I wanted to see how you were doing.
Fine,
he mumbles.
Fine.
What are you doing? I approach, stepping between piles of unopened boxes.
Watching. Waiting.
Jackson remains seated, staring through the large window. He is pale and yellow, almost translucent. His thin hair lies limp and matted across his forehead. His face is unshaven. I can see fine hairs lining his back and arms, stretching down the short lengths of fingers that hold his only photograph of Janet. It hangs loose in his jaundiced hands, obscured under a murk of fingerprints.
Jack, you look terrible.
A smile cracks through his dry lips.
What are you looking at?
I ask, peering out the uncurtained window into the darkness.
The stars. Just the stars.
He says. His slow voice is thick and rough.
What about them?
Haven't seen them for days. All the snow.
From my left, there is a slow scratching that moves across the entire length of wall before stopping.
The light,
he says.
It takes so long. So very long to get here.
I don't understand. What light?
Hundreds. Hundreds, so long they might already be gone. Burned away. We can't even know. Hundreds of years, but still there's light.
Listen, Jack, you can't stay like this.
I wonder who is saying these words.
Let's get out of here. We'll...
The sound of crashing glass fills the space above us.
How can you stand this? Come on, I'm getting you out of here before the roof collapses.
I place my hand on Jackson's shoulder, and a feeling of revulsion overcomes me. His skin, cold and wet, pushes aside under the light pressure creeping between my fingers as they sink into his flesh. I pull my hand away, and for a moment, I feel a slight resistance before it is freed, leaving the shallow imprint of my palm upon his back. It takes too long for the shape to fill.
You shouldn't stay here,
he says. And finally turns his head, fixing two sunken, bloodshot eyes on my own. From outside the door, there is a rumble.
Go, now.
I barely keep from tripping. The hallway is dark and empty, and from the stairs there is a noise of something coming. I don't know what it is, but it casts a shadow, huge and misshapen, that ripples across the wall. That scratching sound follows amid an awful slurping. The smell is overpowering. Putrid, like awful, it crawls into my sinuses. Through the stairwell glass is the murky flash of something black and shiny and bulbous pulsing out. I run, coughing, scrambling to the opposite exit. Outside, the cold air hits me, and I fumble the barking dog's leash free with a slick hand as behind me the windows start to rattle. I have to go back. After 3 days of hiding in my empty house, of taking the dog only as far as the yard, of dreaming about shapeless voids, I feel like everything is falling apart. My project is in ruins, photographs and paper torn to pieces in a midnight frenzy I no longer remember. I can't work, I can't sleep, I can't think about anything but Jackson and what happened. It all seems so impossible in the daylight, yet every shadow tells me otherwise. I have to go back. The snow, after a brief respite, is falling again, filling the air with large wet flakes that weigh heavy on the late afternoon, muting the light. I stand outside the building uneasy, looking through the trees at the rows of dim windows, unable to bring myself to enter. There is a white card peeking through the window by the front door, but I can't read it very well. The glass is smeared with grime. The dog's incessant barking catches my attention, and I see it digging its way through the snow and into the pile of black garbage bags. The sight fills me with dread, tugging at the back of my memory. The dog manages to tear a hole in the wet plastic before I can stop it, a hole big enough to fit through, before it yelps and retreats behind my leg. From the bag pours a foul, viscous liquid, pale in the gray light. The dog stops jumping momentarily to smell the expanding pool before darting back to my side. However, the putrid liquid creeping around my feet barely registers.
I'm fixed at the sight of a familiar face, staring out at me from the ragged hole. It is smiling, and it is frozen, adjusting a tilted hat that is far too large for it.
I listened to The Things by Peter Watts recently, as read by the excellent Kate Baker. It's a magnificent story. John Carpenter's The Thing from the point of view of The Thing, and it paints a fascinating picture, a picture of a creature terrified by the idea, the very existence of individuality, by humanity's acceptance of a single shape. It's up at clarksworldmagazine.com now, and I cannot recommend it highly enough. Why, you might ask, am I recommending another podcast talking about another story on the back end of such a fine piece of work like this? Well, it's twofold. Firstly, because there's no such thing as too much information about free things, or Timmy Appafoot for short, which is one of my operating philosophies. And secondly, because the idea of haunting and controlling through anonymity is at the centre of Watts' story, just as it is here. Cities fascinate me because I'm a country mouse. The idea of humanity fitting together in a way which makes each cog vital and at the same time each cog disposable is a concept that authors from Kipling, who admittedly use the concept of empire more, to Clive Barker have explored, and Simon's work here stands shoulder to shoulder with them. In certain parts of England, you are never more than 10 feet away from a rat. In others, foxes and toads live literally on top of or beneath humanity. The streetlight never stretches the whole way, never illuminates everything, and the end result is that even in this day and age, where getting lost is very nearly a thing of the past, where pigs glow and where we can watch avalanches on Mars, even now, there are things on the dark side of the street, things that move, that run, that laugh, things that terrify us because they wear the skin of things we've seen before and trust, loved ones, animals, buildings. But it's just the skin. Thanks for taking us there, Simon. Now, if you could just point me at the door. Oh, look, a collection box right near the door. And what's that, it says? Anytime you give money to Pseudopod, it goes to pay our server costs and authors and makes you a bona fide good egg? Why, that sounds like a fine plan. Go to pseudopod.org and click on Feed the Pod to find out more and do the deed. Pseudopod is a production of Escape Artists Incorporated and is released under a Creative Commons Attribution Non-Commercial No Derivatives License. And Pseudopod knows not only that the war is over, but that the good guys lost.